Hi, David Mayhem. This is For the Record program number 1378. Team Trump takes the field, part four. This is being recorded on April 15th of the year 2025. Well, happy PAX deadline day, if in fact this could be called a happy time. I don't think there's a whole lot that's happy about it. But we are going to be talking about something that is striking many people as new. Indeed, there are some relatively novel features about it. And yet, at the same time, the overall paradigm that we are looking at concerns the corporate state, or really the fashioning of a society in such a way as to have it working hand in glove with corporate power. Mussolini called his system the corporate state, or as he put it, il fascismo e il corporatismo. Fascism is corporatism. And as novel as some of the things that we are going to be looking at in the next couple of weeks would appear to be, in fact, I think that what we are looking at is simply a Silicon Valley / tech reworking of the old corporate state, and it is fascist. Before we get to that, a couple of things. The new 64-gigabyte flash drive is available. That has all of my life's work, both written and recorded, plus a mini library of old anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. It would be impossible, I think, to exaggerate the importance of people preserving the historical record and maintaining access to the truth for those who come after, assuming anyone is going to be coming after. All kidding aside, and I don't find any of this amusing, but it goes back to one of my favorite observations by the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, the quote, "A joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling." And boy, have I had a lot of feelings dying lately. But again, I don't think that we are going to make it as a civilization. And I think that as sentient beings, you have an obligation, a sacred obligation. I know how corny that may sound, or self-righteous that may sound, but I think you have a sacred obligation to, at minimum, preserve the record about what happened. You have, I think, an obligation to at least pass on to those who come after a record of what has truly taken place. And there is no better way to do that than to get that 64-gigabyte flash drive of all of my life's work on it printed and recorded, all of the brilliant comments by Tara Fractal, our contributing editor, and again, a mini-library of old anti-fascist books. And I get no money whatsoever from this. But please, 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 please get that flash drive. Again, I get no money from it, because what I've been warning about, and later this year, God willing, and the creek don't rise, I will begin my 47th year on the air. And sadly, what I've been warning people about is taking place. As corny as it may sound, and again, I've said this before, but I went on the air my 30th birthday, and I undertook these programs in much the same spirit that Paul Revere undertook his ride, assuming the mythology is correct. Only instead of riding through the streets of Boston at midnight warning, "The redcoats are coming, the redcoats are coming," I was, at least theoretically, riding through downtown America saying, "The brown shirts are coming, the brown shirts are coming. They murdered the president. You've got to do something." Well, that was quite correct. And Well, get the flash drive again. No, I get no money from that, and I very much wish that I was wrong. I wish that I was as crazy as my critics have made me out to be, but sadly, things are coming to pass as I have seen them coming to pass. I mean, we've got Elon Musk giving a Nazi salute at the inauguration, and people don't blink. Well, things are very, very late. It is very, very late in the day. Now, again, one of the things that we are going to be talking about, and one of the things that is at one level to me gratifying and another very frustrating, that is finally, after the better part of half a century, to be warning people about fascism coming to America. Now a lot of people are beginning to take stock of that. But what they're not doing, folks, they're not taking stock of what is the prelude or the prelude to fascism, which is a wave of political assassinations. What happened to the Kennedy brothers? What happened to Martin Luther King and so many others? This is one of the things that precedes fascism. And we don't hear about it in Germany. There was a wave of political assassinations performed by the so-called Black Reichswehr, or underground military of the German army. And they ranged from doctrinaire Marxists like Rosa Luxemburg to conservative social democrats like Walter von Rathenau. But basically all of the political leadership that could have successfully resisted Hitler was dead by 1933. Actually, most of them were dead well before. And in Japan as well, there was a wave of political assassinations, the most best known of which perhaps is the May 15th incident, as it is known in Japan. May 15th, 1932, when Prime Minister Kai Inukai was assassinated by naval cadets from the Native Land-Loving School. And people have ignored that. And now, here we are. So, none of the histories that I will be unpacking really go into this. By the way, before we get into this, something that was a brilliant contribution by Parafractal, again, a brilliant contributing editor. There have been a couple of articles in the Daily Mail, supposedly this huge underground technological complex was found beneath the Great Pyramids of Giza, and this is supposed to indicate the presence of some powerful civilization long gone, perhaps aliens built the pyramids. Elon Musk sent out, I guess it wouldn't have been a tweet, an ex-social media message saying that the pyramids were built by aliens. This is the whole, you know, Chariots of the Gods, Eric von Daniken BS, but now, there have been two articles in the Daily Mail which have ignored the fact that the presence, that this alleged discovery has been thoroughly discredited. And yet, Anna Polina Luna, the congressperson who is presiding over the synthesized inquiries into the JFK assassination, the Robert Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, the September 11th, and a whole lot of other things. The Jeffrey Epstein files, let's not forget those. Anna Polina Luna has expressed great interest in this obvious BS, and it makes me want to tear my hair or say something on the air that the FCC would not like, so I'm not going to do that. But again, with the public hearings into the assassinations being presided over by Ms. Luna, and she is an enthusiastic, she's in thrall with this absolute BS. I think maybe in our next program I'll unpack that. But again, a characteristically brilliant, incisive contribution from our contributing editor, Tara Fractal. Now, as I said, there have been some important articles, finally, I guess in an example of too little too late, perhaps. But there are those who are taking note of the arrival of fascism in the U.S. And the following, I'm going to excerpt a New Yorker article from February 26th of 2025. That's by Kyle Chavka, C-H-A-V-K-A, or maybe that's A-Y-K-A. It's called Techno-Fascism Comes to America, the Historic Parallels That Help Elon Musk's Rampage on the Federal Government. And it reads in part as follows. When the phalanx of the top Silicon Valley executives Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Google's Sundar Pichai aligned behind President Trump during the inauguration in January, many observers saw an allegiance based on corporate interests. The ultra-wealthy CEOs were printing out to support a fellow magnate, hoping perhaps for an era of deregulation, tax breaks, and anti-quote woke unquote cultural shifts. The historian Janice, capital J-A-M-I-S, Mimura, capital M-I-M-U-R-A, saw something more ominous. A new proactive union of industry and governmental power wherein the state would drive aggressive industrial policy at the expense of liberal norms. Well, this is not new. This is the corporate state, as Mussolini termed his system. Continuing. In the second Trump administration, a class of Silicon Valley leaders was insinuating itself into politics in a way that recalled one of Mimura's primary subjects of study, the elite bureaucrats who seized political power and drove Japan into the Second World War. Quote, these are experts with a technological mindset and background, often engineers, who now have a special role in the government, unquote, Nomura told me. The result is what in her book, quote, Planning for Empire, from 2011, she labeled, quote, techno-fascism, unquote, authoritarianism driven by technocrats. Technology, quote, is considered the driving force, unquote, of such a regime, Nomura said. Again, quoting, there's a sort of technicization of all aspects of government and society, unquote. In the 1930s, Japan colonized Manchuria in northeastern China, and the region became a test ground for techno-fascism. Kishi Nobusuke, a Japanese Commerce Ministry bureaucrat, was appointed to head the industrial program in Manchuria in 1936, and with the collaboration of a new crop of the Japanese conglomerates known as Zaibatsu, he instituted a policy of forced industrial development based on the exploitation of the local population. When Kishi returned to national politics in Japan in 1939, along with a clique of other Japanese technocrats who had worked in Manchuria, he pursued similar strategies of state-dictated industrialization at the expense of private interests and labor rights. Skipping down. As she explained, techno-fascist officials, quote, acquire power by creating these super-ministerial organs and agencies, subgroups within the bureaucracy that were unaccountable, unquote. Today, Elon Musk's Doge is the Trumpian equivalent. And the writer goes on to say, American corporations of the 20th century flirted with a merging of state and industrial power. The entrepreneur Henry Ford, by the way, one of Hitler's earliest and most prominent financial backers, as we look at in Miscellaneous Archive Show M11, and also reprised in For the Record program 511. American corporations of the 20th century flirted with a merging of state and industrial power. The entrepreneur Henry Ford promoted a system of industrial organization that came to be known as, quote, Fordism, unquote, whereby the state would intervene in the economy to guarantee mass production and consumption. In the 1930s, IBM did business with the Nazi government through a German subsidiary lending its technology to projects like the 1933 census, which helped identify Jews in the country. It was far more than that, as we've seen, but continuing. As a recent feature in The Guardian by Becca Lewis laid out, Silicon Valley itself has exhibited right-wing tendencies, although that for decades, embracing misogynist and hierarchical attitudes about achievement. The journalist Michael S. Malone, M-A-L-O-M-E, was issuing warnings about emerging, quote, techno-fascism, unquote, way back in the late 90s, when he warned about, quote, IQ bigotry, unquote, in the tech industry, and the willingness of people to push forward digital revolution while, quote, tossing out the weak and wounded along the way, unquote. But our current moment marks a new conjunction of internet entrepreneur and day-to-day government operations. American techno-fascism is no longer a philosophical abstraction for Silicon Valley to tinker with in the limits. One more time. American techno-fascism is no longer a philosophical abstraction for Silicon Valley to tinker with in the vein of intermittent fasting or therapeutic ketamine doses. It is a policy program whose constitutional limits are being tested right now as Doge, staffed with inexperienced engineers linked to Musk's own companies, rampages through the federal government. And it really, it is very challenging to select the material. There is so much going on, and with Elon Musk's little muskrats, basically being given access to people's sensitive data. You know, when you are online and you visit a Blogspot or something, and they say, you know, this site uses cookies, blah, 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 you know, and you click on the little thing, don't sell my personal information. Well, you know, Elon Musk has given them a bunch of junior league techno-fascists, basically, access to your personal information. And who gave them permission? But at some point, I think we really should go into Marco Velez and the people that Musk has turned loose. But there is a thoughtful article now, again, thinking about not only techno-fascism, but the Silicon Valley version of the corporate state. And we're going to be looking at various overlapping theories here, including the theoretical constructs of a very important individual named Curtis Yarvin, Y-A-R-V-I-N, who posts under the name Mencius Moldbug, M-O-L-B-B-U-G. He has found that he doesn't believe in democracy and believes that we should have some sort of a techno-monarchy, and has, instead of countries, we have little platforms, and the head of that, well, the term is that if someone is not doing what they should be doing, they can become unalive. It's a wonderful term for killing somebody, but these ideologies are extremely important, and again, this is a Silicon Valley version of the old corporate state. It really is. They say there's nothing new under the sun. Well, this sure as bloody hell isn't new, but it has a new adaptation. The following is from the Notes from the Circus blog of February 8th of 2025. It's by Mike Rock, B-R-O-C-K, and it's titled The Plot Against America, subtitled How a Dangerous Ideology Born from the Libertarian Movement Stands Ready to Seize America. And once again, none of the articles that I have read in this series, they talk about fascism coming to America, but they don't talk about what led up to it. They don't talk about the murders. And that is very, very, very sad indeed, because you can't understand what has happened without understanding those murders. Now, again, I won't be able to finish this article in this program. We'll continue it in our next broadcast. But again, The Plot Against America, How a Dangerous Ideology Born from the Libertarian Movement Stands Ready to Seize America. It's by Mike Brock from February 8th of 2025, and it reads as follows. As I write this in early 2025, a quiet revolution is unfolding within the U.S. government. Inside the newly created Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, teams of young tech operatives are systematically dismantling democratic institutions and replacing them with proprietary artificial intelligence systems. Civil servants who raise legal objections are being removed. Government databases are being migrated to private servers. Decision-making power is being transferred from elected officials and career bureaucrats to algorithms controlled by a small network of Silicon Valley elites. This is not a spontaneous coup. It is the culmination of a dangerous ideology that has been meticulously developed since the 2008 financial crisis, one that sees democracy itself as obsolete technology ready to be, quote, disrupted, unquote. To understand how we reached this critical moment and why it threatens the very foundation of democratic governance, we need to trace the evolution of an idea that democracy is not just inefficient but fundamentally incompatible with technological progress. And once again, none of these analysts, as important as what they have to say is and as articulate, and I would be reading this if I didn't agree with it, but they didn't think it was important, but they don't talk about the murders. What happened to JFK? That was a coup d'etat, and the U.S. is no longer a democracy. It doesn't have a free press, and there is no, quote, left, unquote. They use it to pick people off and alienate them. But continuing, last sentence again. To understand how we reached this critical moment and why it threatens the very foundation of democratic governments, we need to trace the evolution of an idea that democracy is not just inefficient, but fundamentally incompatible with technological progress. DOGE is not about efficiency. It is about erasure. Democracy is being deleted in slow motion, replaced by proprietary technology and AI models. It is a coup d'etat executed not with guns, but with back-end migrations and database wipes. What follows is not speculation or dystopian fiction. It is a carefully documented account of how a dangerous ideology born in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis has moved from the fringes of tech culture to the heart of American governments. The story of how it begins starts 16 years ago. On September 15th, 2008, Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, marking the largest failure of an investment bank since the Great Depression. This event catalyzed the global financial crisis, leading to widespread economic hardship and a profound loss of faith in established institutions. In the aftermath of the crisis, several key figures emerged who would go on to shape a new movement in American politics. Curtis Yarvin, capital C-U-R-P-I-S, last name capital Y-A-R-V-I-N, writing under the pseudonym Mencius Moldba, capital M-E-N-C-I-U-S, last name capital M-O-L-B-B-U-G, had been developing a critique of modern democracy on his blog Unqualified Reservations since 2007. As the financial crisis unfolded, Yarvin applied his unconventional analysis to the economic turmoil. In a 2008 post, quote, "The Misesian explanation of the bank crisis," unquote, Yarvin wrote, briefly, "The fundamental cause of the bank crisis is not evil Republicans, lying Democrats, deregulation, unquote, quote, affirmative action lending, unquote, or even, quote, ludicrous levels of leverage, unquote. A banking system is like a nuclear reactor, a complicated piece of engineering. If it's engineered right, it works 100% of the time. If it's engineered wrong, it works 99.9%. If it's engineered wrong, it works 99.99% of the time, and the other 0.01%, it coats the entire tri-state area in radioactive strontium." Curtis, oh, by the way, before I get into this, There is a program, for the record, program 412, recorded in early June of 2003, and it's titled The Engineer Intends to Wreck the Train. The 2008 financial collapse was absolutely deliberate, and again, I noted that. I said that the engineer, meaning George W. Bush, the president, intends to wreck the train. The financial collapse of 2008 was absolutely deliberate. I predicted it on the air, and it's in the archives in June, early June of 2003. Again, the engineer intends to wreck the train, and he bloody well did. Continuing. Irvin argued that the crisis was fundamentally an engineering failure caused by a deviation from what he called Misesian baggage, capital M-I-S-E-S-I-A-N, based on principles outlined by economist Ludwig von Mises. This approach advocates for a strict free market system with minimal government intervention in banking. He contrasted this with the prevailing Bagehopian system, capital B-A-G-E-H-O-P-I-A-N, named after Walter Bagehope, or I remember, probably mispronounced that, B-A-G-E-H-O-P, which supports central bank intervention during financial crises. Yarvin argued that this interventionist approach was inherently unstable and prone to collapse. Yarvin's writings during the crisis period continued to develop his broader critique of modern political and economic systems. His ideas, while not mainstream, began to resonate with a growing audience disillusioned with traditional institutions and seeking alternative explanations for the economic turmoil. For decades, libertarian thinkers had argued that free markets left unrestrained would naturally outperform any system of government. But what if the problem wasn't just government interference in markets? What if the very concept of democracy itself was flawed? This was the argument put forward by Hans Hermann Hoppe, H-O-P-P-E, a student of Mises' protege Murray Rothbard, who took libertarian skepticism of the state to its extreme conclusion. By the way, I think he's the fellow who developed the concept of voluntary slavery. Again, the milieu of Eddie Snowden is also the milieu of the neo-Confederate movement, and literally people who advocate voluntary slavery. I mean, so much of this is surreal. They've been, oh, Eddie Snowden, no, he's wonderful. Yeah, I will have to attenuate this because of the FCC, but Eddie Snowden, while working in 2009, while posted by the CIA for Switzerland, posted on social media, quote, "The elderly wouldn't be effing helpless if you'd stop sending them effing checks so they could sit on their A-blank-blanks and lay in hospitals all day." That is Eddie Snowden. And again, he hooks up with people who believe in slavery. Continuing, speaking of Murray Rothbard, his 2001 book, Democracy, the God That Failed, landed like a bombshell in libertarian circles. Published at a moment when many Americans still saw democracy as the, quote, end of history, unquote, Hoppe argued that democracy was an inherently unstable system, one that incentivized short-term decision-making and mob rule rather than rational governance. His alternative? A return to monarchy. But this wasn't the monarchy of old. Hoppe envisioned a new order, one where governance was privatized, where societies functioned as covenant communities, unquote, owned and operated by property holders rather than elected officials. In this world, citizenship was a matter of contract, not birthright. Voting was unnecessary. Rule was left to those with the most capital at stake. It was libertarian thought taken to its most extreme conclusion, a society governed not by political equality but by property rights alone. By the 2010s, Hoppe's radical skepticism of democracy had found an eager audience beyond the usual libertarian circles, but through a different mechanism than simple market disruption. While Silicon Valley had long embraced Clayton Christensen's theory of disruptive innovation, where nimble companies could outcompete established players by serving overlooked markets, a more extreme form of techno-solutionism had begun to take hold. This mindset held that any societal problem, including governments itself, could be, quote, solved, unquote, through sufficient application of engineering principles. Silicon Valley elites who had built successful companies began to view democratic processes not just as inefficient, but as fundamentally irrational, the product of what they saw as emotional decision-making by non-technical people. This merged perfectly with Hoppe's critique. If democracy was simply a collection of feeling-based, unquote, choices made by the uninformed masses, surely it could be replaced by something more, quote, rational, unquote, specifically the kind of data-driven, engineering-focused governance these tech leaders practiced in their own companies. Peter Thiel, one of the most outspoken erstwhile libertarians in Silicon Valley, put this sentiment in stark terms in his 2009 essay, The Education of a Libertarian, quote, "I no longer believe that freedom and democracy are compatible," unquote. Thiel had already begun funding projects aimed at escaping democratic nation states entirely, including seasteading, floating cities in international waters beyond government control, and experimental governance models that would replace electoral democracy with private, corporate-style rule. Hoppe's vision of covenant communities, private enclaves owned and governed by elites, provided an intellectual justification for what Thiel and his allies were trying to build. Not just alternatives to specific government policies, but complete replacements for government, for democratic governance itself. One more time. Hoppe's vision of covenant communities, private enclaves owned and governed by elites, provided an intellectual justification for what Thiel and his allies were trying to build. Not just alternatives to specific government policies, but complete replacements for democratic governance itself. If democracy is too inefficient to keep up with technological change, why not replace it entirely with private, contractual forms of rule? The notion that traditional democratic governance was inefficient or outdated resonated with those who saw themselves as disruptors and innovators. The intellectual through line from Mises to Hoppe to figures like Yarvin and Thiel helps explain the emergence of what some have called techno-libertarianism, unquote. It represents a dangerous alignment of anti-democratic thought with immense technological and financial resources, posing significant challenges to traditional conceptions of democratic governance and civic responsibility. From Silicon Valley, the next section is called From Silicon Valley to Main Street, The Spread of Techno-Libertarian Ideas. 2008 did not just destroy the economy, it shattered faith in democratic institutions themselves. Libertarians saw an opportunity, and in Silicon Valley, a new belief took hold. And again, the financial collapse of 2008 was deliberate. Again, for the record, 412, the engineer intends to wreck the train from early June of 2003. I'll put a link in the written description for this program. And in Silicon Valley, well, actually, I'll set this whole section. From Silicon Valley to Main Street, the spread of techno-libertarian ideas. 2008 did not just destroy the economy, it shattered faith in democratic institutions themselves. Libertarians saw an opportunity, and in Silicon Valley, a new belief took hold. Democracy wasn't just inefficient, it was obsolete. Over the next decade, the ideas incubated in this period will evolve into a coherent challenge to the foundations of liberal democracy, backed by some of the most powerful figures in technology and finance. As millions of Americans lost their homes and jobs in the years following the crisis, these ideas began to gain momentum. The Tea Party movement emerged in 2009, channeling populist anger against government bailouts and the Obama administration's response to the financial crisis. As the Tea Party gained momentum, it fostered a broader cultural shift that primed many Americans to be receptive to alternative political and economic theories. This shift extended beyond traditional conservatism, creating an opening for the tech libertarian ideas emerging from Silicon Valley. The movement's emphasis on individual liberty and skepticism of centralized authority resonated with the anti-government sentiment growing in tech circles. As a result, concepts like cryptocurrency and decentralized governments, once considered fringe, began to find a more mainstream audience among those disillusioned with traditional political and financial systems. By the way, jumping in very quickly, watch the bleep out for cryptocurrency, folks. I mean, Trump may be talking about, all that is computer code. You want to talk about a fiat currency? You want to talk about something that is primed for collapse? My goodness, cryptocurrency is nothing but computer code. One more time. Continuing with this article. The convergence of populist anger and techno-utopianism set the stage for more radical anti-democratic ideas that would emerge in the following years. The Tea Party, while not directly advocating for these ideas, inadvertently prepared a segment of the population to be more open to the notion that traditional democratic institutions might be fundamentally flawed or obsolete. However, the ideological impact of Silicon Valley's economic performance on movements like the, quote, New Right, unquote, was not immediate, nor was it direct. The tech industry's growing economic and cultural influence gradually became more pronounced in the 2010s as tech leaders like Peter Thiel began to more actively engage in political discourse and funding. The financial crisis did not just create political movements like the Tea Party. It spawned entirely new media platforms that would help spread these anti-democratic ideas far beyond their original circles. One of the most influential was Zero Hedge, founded in 2009 by Daniel, and I'm not sure how the last name is, but IDANDJIISKI. By the way, they do have some good posts on that, but I won't spend a lot of time with it. Continuing, the site, which adopted the pseudonym, quote, Pirate Burden, unquote, for all its authors, a reference to the anti-establishment character from the Fight Club, initially focused on financial news and analysis from a bearish perspective rooted in Austrian economics. Zero Hedge's evolution from a financial blog to a political powerhouse exemplified how anti-democratic ideas could be launched through technical expertise. The site gained initial credibility through sophisticated critiques of high-frequency trading and market structure, establishing itself as a legitimate voice in financial circles. But this technical authority became a vehicle for something more radical, the idea that democratic institutions themselves were as broken as the markets they regulated. By 2015, Zero Hedge was advancing a comprehensive critique of democratic governance that paralleled Garvin's, but packaged for a mainstream audience. Its technical analysis of market failures seamlessly evolved into broader arguments about the failure of democratic institutions. When the site argued that central banks were rigging markets, it wasn't just making a financial claim. It was suggesting that democratic institutions themselves were inherently corrupt and needed to be replaced with more, quote, efficient, unquote, mechanisms. This methodology, using technical financial analysis to justify increasingly radical political conclusions, provided a blueprint that others would follow. The site demonstrated how expertise in one domain, financial markets, could be leveraged to advocate for sweeping political change. When Zero Hedge declared that markets were manipulated, it wasn't just criticizing policy, it was building the case that democracy itself was a failed system that needed to be replaced by technical, algorithmic governance. What made Zero Hedge particularly effective was how it straddled multiple worlds. As Bloomberg noted in 2016, it remained, quote, an internet powerhouse, unquote, with real influence in financial circles, even as the New Republic characterized it as, quote, a forum for the hateful, conspiracy-driven voices of the angry white men of the alt-right, unquote. This dual identity, technically sophisticated yet politically radical, made it a crucial bridge between mainstream financial discourse and emerging anti-democratic ideologies. The site's true innovation wasn't just in mixing finance and politics. It was in suggesting that technical, market-based solutions could replace democratic processes entirely. This aligned perfectly with Silicon Valley's emerging worldview. If markets were more efficient than governments at allocating resources, why not let them allocate political power as well? Again, this sounds like something radical. This is just a Silicon Valley version of the old corporate state. Continuing. While InfoWars would later adopt some of Zero Hedge's anti-establishment positioning, it abandoned the pretense of technical expertise entirely. But Zero Hedge's more sophisticated approach, using financial expertise to justify anti-democratic conclusions, proved more influential in tech circles, where it reinforced the growing belief that democracy was simply an inefficient way to make decisions compared to markets and algorithms. Again, this is a high-tech version of the corporate state, nothing new here. Zero Hedge's transformation from financial analysis to anti-democratic ideology previewed a broader pattern that would define the next decade, how technical expertise could be weaponized against democracy itself. While Zero Hedge used financial analysis to undermine faith in democratic institutions, InfoWars would take a cruder but arguably more effective approach, pure epistemic chaos. As media scholar Yoshi, capital Y-O-C-H-I, Benkler, capital B-E-N-K-L-E-R, noted in the 2018 study, this period saw the emergence of, quote, one more time. As media scholar Yoshi Benkler noted in a 2018 study, this period saw the emergence of a, quote, propaganda feedback loop, unquote, where audiences, media outlets, and political elites reinforced each other's views, regardless of the veracity of the information. Zero Hedge was an early example of this dynamic in action, demonstrating how traditional gatekeepers of information were losing their influence. This erosion of trust in established institutions, combined with the proliferation of alternative information sources, set the stage for what social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-B-T, would later describe as, quote, a kind of fragmentation of reality, unquote. As we moved into the 2010s, this fragmentation accelerated. Social media algorithms designed to maximize engagement amplified sensational and divisive content. The resulting flood of competing narratives made it increasingly difficult for citizens to discern truth from fiction, with profound implications for democratic discourse and decision-making. The Zero Hedge model, mixing expert analysis with speculative political commentary, became a template for numerous other outlets, contributing to insular information ecosystems where narrative consistency trumped factual accuracy. This presaged how information would be produced, consumed, and weaponized in the age of social media and algorithmic content distribution. While Zero Hedge pioneered the approach, InfoWars took it to the extreme. Founded by Alex Jones in 1999, InfoWars gained significant traction after the 2008 financial crisis, abandoning any pretense of conventional expertise in favor of sensationalism and conspiracy theories. Quote, the financial crisis created a perfect storm for outlets like InfoWars, unquote, explains media scholar Whitney Phillips. Again, quoting, people were looking for explanations, and InfoWars offered simple, if outlandish, answers to complex problems, unquote. By 2015, InfoWars was generating an estimated $80 million annually, monetizing its audience directly through the sale of supplements and survival gear. This business model, which saw sales spike during crises, demonstrated how post-truth narratives could be converted into profit. InfoWars' impact extended beyond its immediate audience, providing a playbook for a new generation of alternative media outlets. However, its promotion of baseless conspiracy theories had real-world consequences, from harassment of Sandy Hook victims' families to the spread of health misinformation during the COVID-19 pandemic. As these tactics were adopted by a wide range of actors, the post-truth era posed unprecedented challenges to democratic discourse. The partial evolution of Zero Hedge and InfoWars revealed two complementary strategies for undermining democracy. Zero Hedge showed how technical expertise could be used to delegitimize democratic institutions from within, while InfoWars demonstrated how raw chaos could make democratic deliberation impossible. But it was Silicon Valley that would combine these insights into something even more dangerous. The argument that democracy's replacement by technical systems wasn't just desirable, it was inevitable. This epistemic chaos wasn't an accident. It was a crucial tactic in undermining democracy itself. As Curtis Yarvin and his neo-reactionary allies saw it, political legitimacy depended on the existence of a shared reality. Break that consensus, and democracy becomes impossible. Steve Bannon called it flooding the zone with S-blank-blank-blank, unquote. And by the time Trump entered office, the full strategy was in motion. Destabilize public trust, replace expert analysis with endless counter-narratives, and ensure that the only people who could wield power were those who controlled the flow of information itself. Figures like Garvin didn't just critique democracy, they sought to undermine the very conditions in which democratic deliberation is possible. By weaponizing media fragmentation, they hacked the cognitive foundations of democracy itself, ensuring that political power would no longer rest on reasoned debate, but on the ability to manipulate information flows. In the next section, the sovereign individual, blueprint for a post-democratic world. But destroying consensus was only the first step. The true revolution would come through technology itself. In 1999, James Bail Davidson, B-A-V-I-D-S-O-N, and William Rees Mogg, R-E-E-S hyphen M-O-G-G, published a book that would become the blueprint for this technological coup, The Sovereign Individual. Published at the height of the dot-com boom, the book read like science fiction to many at the time. It predicted the rise of cryptocurrency, the decline of traditional nation-states, and the emergence of a new digital aristocracy. Taxes will become voluntary. Regulations will disappear. The most successful people will form their own private, self-governing communities, while the rest of the world is left behind. Libertarianism, when fused with this kind of technological determinism, takes a sharp turn away from classical liberal thought. If you assume that government will inevitably be outcompeted by private networks, decentralized finance, and AI-driven governance, then trying to reform democracy becomes pointless. The more radical conclusion embraced by the figures at the forefront of this movement is that government should be actively dismantled and replaced with a more, quote, efficient, unquote, form of rule, one modeled on corporate governance rather than democratic participation. In other words, it's a high-tech version of the old corporate state of Mussolini. Continuing. This is precisely where libertarianism morphs into neo-reaction. Instead of advocating for a constitutional republic with minimal government, this new strain of thought pushes for a private, post-democratic order where those with the most resources and technological control dictate the rules. One more time. Instead of advocating for a constitutional republic with minimal government, this new strain of thought pushes for a private, post-democratic order where those with the most resources and technological control dictate the rules. In this vision, power doesn't rest with the people. It belongs to the most competent, quote, executives, unquote, running society like a CEO would run a company. In other words, the corporate state. One more time. In this vision, power doesn't rest with the people. It belongs to the most competent, quote, executives, unquote, running society like a CEO would run a company. This is how Curtis Yarman's argument that democracy is an outdated, inefficient system became so appealing to Silicon Valley elites. It wasn't just a philosophical argument. It aligned with the way many in the tech industry already thought about disruption, efficiency, and control. If innovation constantly renders old systems obsolete, then why should governments be any different? Figures like Peter Thiel and Balaji Srinivasan, capital S-R-I-N-I-V-A-S-A-N, took this logic a step further, arguing that rather than resisting the decline of democratic institutions, elites should accelerate the transition to a new order, one where governance is voluntary, privatized, and largely detached from public accountability. The rhetoric of, quote, exit, unquote, and, quote, network states, unquote, became a libertarian justification for abandoning democracy altogether. This wasn't just theoretical. There were actual attempts to implement these ideas, like the Peter Thiel-backed network state project called Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, in Greenland. Gee, fascinating. This mindset is deeply ingrained in Silicon Valley, where disruption is seen not just a business model, but a law of history. One more time. This mindset is deeply ingrained in Silicon Valley, where disruption is seen as not just a business model, but a law of history. Entrepreneurs are taught that old institutions are inefficient relics waiting to be displaced by something better. When applied to government, this logic leads directly to Yarman's argument. Democracy is outdated, quote, legacy code that can't keep up with modern complexity. The future, he and others argue, will belong to those who design and implement a superior system, one that runs more like a corporation, where leaders are chosen based on competence rather than elections. This is why neo-reactionary ideas have found such a receptive audience among tech elites. If you believe that technology inevitably renders old systems obsolete, then why should democracy be any different? Why bother fixing the government if it's doomed to be replaced by something more advanced? This is where the transition from libertarianism to neo-reaction becomes clear. This is where the transition from libertarianism to neo-reaction becomes clear. Classical libertarians at least pay lip service to democracy, arguing that markets should exist within a limited but functioning democratic system. But the Silicon Valley version of libertarianism, shaped by the sovereign individual and reinforced by the rise of cryptocurrency, started to see democratic governance itself as an obstacle. The question was no longer, quote, how do we make government smaller, unquote, but rather, quote, how do we escape government altogether? The answer for people like Yarvin, Peter Thiel, and Balaji Srinivasan was to replace democracy with a new system, one where power belongs to those with the resources to exist and build something better. And as we are now seeing, they aren't waiting for that transition to happen. naturally. Srinivasan, like others in this movement, had undergone an ideological evolution that exemplifies a broader trend in Silicon Valley. As a former CPO of Coinbase and general partner at Andreessen and Horowitz, he initially approached cryptocurrency from a techno-libertarian perspective, viewing it as a tool for individual empowerment and market efficiency. However, his thinking increasingly aligned with neo-reactionary ideas, particularly around the concept of exit, unquote, the ability to opt out of existing political structures entirely. This shift from techno-libertarianism to neo-reactionary thought isn't as large a leap as it might seem. Both ideologies share a deep skepticism of centralized authority and a belief in the power of technology to reshape society. The pipeline from techno-libertarianism to neo-reaction often follows a predictable path. It begins with a libertarian critique of government inefficiency and overreach. This evolves into a broader skepticism of all democratic institutions seen as slow and irrational compared to the speed and logic of technology. Eventually, this leads to the conclusion that democracy itself is an outdated system, incompatible with rapid technological progress. The final step is embracing the idea that democracy should be replaced entirely with more, quote, efficient, unquote, forms of governance, often modeled on corporate structures or technological systems. One more time. The final step is embracing the idea that democracy should be replaced entirely with more efficient, unquote, forms of governance, often modeled on corporate structures or technological systems. Srinivasan's journey along this ideological pipeline is reflected in his evolving views on cryptocurrency. And we'll continue with this in our next program. But again, as, quote, new or revolutionary as this is made out to be, this is just a tech version of the corporate state. And in discussion to come, we're going to take a look at Joshua Holden, Elon Musk's grandfather, who was a doctrinaire fascist in Canada, in the U.S., and then later in South Africa. And he was part of a political party that saw technological ability as a prerequisite for seizing power and governing. Again, nothing democratic about it, but it was sort of a technocratic fascism advocated by Peter Thiel's grandfather in the 1930s and 40s. But that, however, we will come back to some other time. This includes, for the record, program number 1378, Team Trump Takes the Field, Part 4. This is being recorded on April 15th of the year 2025. I'm Dave Emery. Enjoy.